The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The media now admits COVID may have originated in a Wuhan lab.
It obviously didn't come from the food market. That was a cover-up from the very beginning.
The U.S.-Mexico border continues to boil.
So you've got over a million folks already this fiscal year for Border Patrol. 40,000 of those were just in Yuma sector, and we have 115 miles of international boundary.
Democrats come under fire for their criticism of Israel in the Mideast conflict.
I mean, supporting the terrorists, Hamas, over Israel defending its citizens. I mean, what in God's name is going on in this world?
We'll hear from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on anti-Semitic sentiment coming from Democratic representatives in Congress.
That is sick. It is dangerous. And I hope the Democrat Party pushes that out.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, please, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. Before COVID-19 was known to all Americans, Senator Tom Cotton warned back on January 30th of 2020 that this could very well be the start of a global pandemic. And Cotton singled out the Wuhan lab where they work with such deadly pathogens. Soon after, researchers and reporters declared the release of the virus came from a bat in a wet market. And even though there were respected researchers who said otherwise, this wet market theory became solidified in media and Democratic circles. Tom Cotton stuck to his guns, and I might add, so did I. We discussed the matter repeatedly on the Hugh Hewitt Show, including this clip from over a year ago.
We do know the Chinese Communist Party lied about it originating in that so-called food or wet market. It's only responsible, especially in light of this reporting, that we examine the possibility it originated in those laboratories.
For a year, Senator Cotton has been ridiculed by the media for refusing to back down. Slowly this month, experts began admitting the Chinese-pushed wet market story may not be true. And this week, others got on board, scientists and even the media. I spoke with Senator Tom Cotton again on the Hugh Hewitt Show. 15 months ago, maybe 16 months ago, you were warning that the COVID virus could have originated in a CCP-controlled lab inside of Wuhan. And not only were you dismissed, you were ridiculed. And the accounts of this story that are now coming up have as a primary focus the story, but as a secondary focus, why did the media fail? I'd like you to talk about both of them.
Well, Hugh, what I was saying early last year is just what any Arkansan with common sense would say. Isn't it a shocking coincidence that a novel coronavirus emerged not in some remote village next to a colony of bats living in a nearby cave, but in downtown Wuhan, a city larger than New York, with two labs known to research coronaviruses? I mean, what a shocking coincidence. And since then, the evidence has all piled up in the direction of those laboratories. As I wrote in the Wall Street Journal last April, it obviously didn't come from the food market. That was a cover-up from the very beginning. We knew that they were researching coronaviruses. Our diplomats had gone there in 2018 and reported on shockingly lax safety practices. And even since this controversy last spring, we've had more evidence. You know, look, I presume the Chinese officials have been trying to find the original animal, the original host species from which this originated. It only took them 4 months to find SARS. It only took 9 months to find MERS. No one has been able to point to any host species out in the wild from which this coronavirus would have originated. We've also learned that the shoddy safety practices at those labs was worse than we believed. You know, it is a safety level 4 lab, the most intense kind of safety practices. But they were doing this research under level 2 protocols. I mean, Hugh, that's basically what you see when you go to the dentist, you know, a white lab coat and a face shield. And then also, it's just, again, common sense. We now know that this virus, spreads almost exclusively indoors, not outdoors. Isn't it strange that a virus that spreads only indoors is claimed by the Chinese to have originated outdoors in animals? So it's time for the Chinese Communist Party to come clean and give full access to those labs and their personnel in Wuhan. As for the media bias, which was obvious and silly at the time, now it's being exposed because this evidence is piling up and you have respected science reporters like Nicholas Wade, formerly the New York Times, who is pointing out just how shoddy the media's reporting was on this last year. I think there's no question they did that in part because I was the first to raise it. And let's just be fair, a lot of people in the blue media don't care for my politics. They also didn't want to feed into anything that the Trump administration said about China's responsibility here. And of course, you have a bunch of liberals and activists in white lab coats, who I won't even call public health experts, who sometimes seem to care more about protecting the reputations of their fellow activists in white lab coats and their fellow scientists around the world than they care about getting to the truth.
Now, Senator Cotton, there is a second cover-up underway. The Chinese Communist Party has a cover-up of the origins of the virus in coordination with the WHO. But the cover-up by the media for the media is what alarms me this morning. I read Glenn Kessler, my colleague at The Washington Post, account, allegedly an account of the chronology of the Wuhan story. And it references that you were first to the bell by a lot. But it does not reference the blowback. It just does not in any way detail the number and force with which that story was suppressed. Not unlike the Hunter Biden story. That is a cover-up. And it's a cover-up that serves the continuing credibility of a media that is leaking it away in real time. Do you expect that will change? For example, will the Sunday shows invite you? I mean, you're the guy who went to the bell first. Will they invite you to come and discuss what happened?
Something tells me probably not, because, as you say, the media is covering for itself, as they always do when they make blatant partisan mistakes. It's not unlike these activists and liberals in white lab coats covering for each other. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci continues to play word games about NIH funding for this research in the Wuhan laboratories. It's in part because he doesn't want to imperil the relationships that United States scientists have built with scientists around the world. Likewise with the media. They'll cover up the mistakes that they made just on a general reporting level, but they want to put down the memory hole, to use Orwell's phrase, their own partisan attacks, their own baseless slanders against people like me and others who said what was just common sense. This virus emerged a few blocks from labs that is researching exactly these kind of viruses. Maybe we should at least ask the questions about what happened there.
And our conversation on February 18th of last year, we talked about the number of places you've been ridiculed. And I'm being very self-serving. If there was a Pulitzer awarded for continuous, aggressive warning reporting that was eventually proven true about this virus, I would win it. And Byron York would come in second. But the media did not want to hear it. I mean, they just did not want to hear it. I think it had more to do with you than it did the theory, because the theory was always imminently reasonable, not dispositive, right? You can't have dispositive proof about that which you cannot test. But that they locked us out of the lab was, to me, one of those dogs that barked that you have to just look at.
Yeah, Hugh, that's right. I mean, the media was attacking me from the very beginning, not because they disagreed with the questions I was asking, not because they thought there was conclusive proof that the virus originated in some food market in downtown Wuhan, but because they don't like my politics.
To hear my entire interview with Senator Tom Cotton about his belated vindication, go to townhallreview.com. As the world deals with Mideast turmoil, the close of a pandemic and inflation fears, the media has lost track of an enormous story, our border crisis. Salem host Mike Gallagher traveled to the border to see what is happening up close. Well, there he spoke with Yuma, Arizona Sheriff Leon Wilmot.
This is the Yuma County Sheriff Leon Wilmot yesterday at the border.
Law enforcement is playing such an important role in this border crisis. Sheriff Wilmot, Yuma County, you guys are going through. You got to be seen at all morning, noon, and night. Talk a little bit about the way your deputies interact with Border Patrol and what kind of that looks like to people who may not know what it's like here at the border.
for us as the sheriff's office, our concern is obviously that criminal element that so often follows what the cartels are exploiting right now, and that's the family unit crisis. So I've got my troops helping Border Patrol fill the gap on the border. Because right now, because of the amount of folks that are coming across, about 50% of the Border Patrol's agents are stuck in their main office doing paperwork. So we're missing about half of what's coming across. The last word that we had was over 800,000 apprehensions along the southwestern border. Of that, they've caught 6,000 criminals who've been convicted in the U.S. of a crime, served their time, was expelled, and then now they're trying to sneak back in. The scary part is you've had over 72,000 unaccompanied children on top of that. The real scary part for us in Arizona is 63,000 have been getaways on top of that. So we have 63,000 individuals who have come in our border between the ports of entry, entered illegally, and we don't know who they are, what their intents are, or what country they're from. Because right now you're looking at 144 different countries of that 800,000.
Right.
Now you have, on top of that, 200,000 total getaways across the whole southwestern border. So you've got over 1 million folks already this fiscal year for Border Patrol. 40,000 of those were just in Yuma sector, and we have 115 miles of international boundary. So my detention transport folks working on overtime through Operation Stone Garden are actually driving the transport vans to help Border Patrol keep their agents out on the line.
When we got here, we saw one of them. We drove right by us, and they had just, I think, apprehended a group of migrants right by us.
Yeah, they've had 15 so far that they've transported, Honduras, Venezuela, and Cuba. Is what they've had today. 300 apprehensions yesterday. A fellow sheriff, a friend of mine that's in Del Rio, Texas, they had 538 yesterday down there in his town, and it's a lot smaller than Yuma.
I was watching over the weekend, and my listeners were calling in about the drone footage over the weekend that Fox News was showing of a handful of a man. Two of the men looked like they were handcuffed to each other, which suggests that maybe they had been in law enforcement custody prior to breaking and coming across the border. No one could quite understand that.
Yeah, neither can I on that aspect of it. But the concern we have is that criminal element out on our eastern desert right now, and the lack of prosecution by the U.S. Attorney's Office on drugs. Smugglers. So my Border Patrol partners are out there. They're intercepting groups of six at a time, smuggling hundreds of pounds of meth. Why is it our U.S. Attorney's Office isn't charging these people is beyond me. So if you don't have a consequence delivery from our federal government on drug smugglers, that means Border Patrol would have to let them go.
Coming up, a Democrat challenges fellow Democrats.
I mean, supporting the terrorists, Hamas, over Israel defending its citizens. I mean, what in God's name is going on in this world?
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When Mike Pompeo was Secretary of State under President Donald Trump, Israel had a rock-solid ally in the United States. With just a few months left in the Trump administration, Pompeo made history as the first Secretary of State to visit an Israeli settlement in what was known as the occupied West Bank and in Israel known as Samaria and Judea. But the Biden administration is getting a tremendous amount of pressure from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, a significant strand of which is disturbingly anti-Semitic. Pompeo sat in with Salem host Joe Piscopo on AM 970 The Answer out of New York City.
Under the Trump administration, the world
felt a safer place. It was just you really had a handle on everything. The Abraham Accords. This was an incredible accomplishment. And then the disarray between Hamas and Israel now, we know what happened, emboldening Iran, correct me if I'm wrong, and then Iran goes to Hamas, they get the weapons, they fire rockets into Israel, and then, lo and behold, Israel is the bad guy. I mean, thank God there's peace. Do you think this will last, sir?
Well, Joe, it's good news that they've declared a ceasefire. That's always good. Less loss of life is always better. But remember, this isn't the first time there's been a ceasefire between these terrorists, Hamas and Israel. It is almost certainly the case that one day the Israelis will have to confront this again, because in the end, what hasn't changed as a result of the ceasefire or the violence over these past 10, 11 days is Hamas's intent to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. That hasn't changed. Their mission set remains the same, and they're going to have even more money. The Biden administration appears prepared to give billions of dollars of relief to the Iranian regime. Some of that money will find its way to Hezbollah, to the terrorists in Yemen, the Houthis, and to the Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip. And they'll reload, they'll rearm, they'll re-prepare themselves, and someday they'll decide it's in their best interest. And, you know, too many in the world will fault Israel when it just wants to defend its own citizens, and we'll be right back in this soup again. At least that's my fear.
It was interesting to see, and I hesitate to ask you to comment on it because you're such a decent fellow, Mr. Secretary. You really are. But when I saw Joe Biden coming out, and it looked like they were insinuating they were taking credit for this, and that Kamala Harris talked to the King of Jordan, and I'm just shaking my head saying, I don't think that's how it happened. Let me put it this way, if I may. Why does it seem the Biden administration just doesn't back Israel the way the Trump administration did? Is that a fair enough question?
Yeah, Joe, it is. It's very different. You'll remember the president doesn't call Prime Minister Netanyahu for weeks at the beginning of the administration. They turned on the spigot. The Biden administration turned on the spigot of funding to the Palestinian Authority. We cut it off. We made clear we had other partners in the region, too, and they joined the Abraham Accords. So friends like the Emiratis and the Bahrainis, we made clear that Iran was the problem, and Israel and the Gulf states working together was the deterrent model to keep things like this from happening. I can't explain why. I will tell you this, Joe. When I first came to Congress, there was a lot of bipartisanship. Republicans, Democrats all supported Israel.
Yeah.
And that appears to be diminishing, falling away, not just from the hardcores like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, but now seeping even further into the Democrat Party that somehow Israel is morally equivalent to Hamas. That is sick. It is dangerous. And I hope the Democrat Party pushes that out. It needs to be bipartisan in support of Israel.
And it'd be nice to see President Biden, when he talks about hate, and rightly so, there should be no hate against anybody, but he never addressed the anti-Semitic rise in America now and our Jewish brothers and sisters being attacked, Mr. Secretary, on the streets of New York City in Los Angeles. And the president doesn't even address this?
Joe, I've seen these stories in New York, in Southern California. And we've seen it around the world, too, in Spain, in London. We've seen anti-Semitism not only growing, but now turning violent in these places.
Yeah.
Haven't heard much from the administration about this. We worked hard. We had a great special envoy working to push back against anti-Semitism all around the world. This was at the center. This idea of religious freedom and the capacity of Israel as the rightful Jewish homeland to continue to exist was at the center of how we thought about not only security for America, but Middle East stability. I regret to see this. This anti-Semitism rise in the United States is dangerous. We've got to push back against it.
Dove Hikind is a Democrat who represents Brooklyn's District 98 in the New York State Assembly. Brooklyn is where some of the high-profile attacks in recent days have come against Jewish residents. Hikind spoke with Mike Gallagher about his frustration with Democrats' resistance to calling out the anti-Semitism.
I hope that we don't lose sight of some of the horrific anti-Semitic attacks that are happening in this country from New York to Chicago to L.A. Give us the latest and give me your perspective, Dove Hikind, as we better confront the hatred, the bigotry, the evil that we are seeing playing out right in front of our faces.
Mike, you said it. It's the vitriol, the hate. You see it on the faces of those attacking Jews. I mean, there is something really, really wrong going on, something horrible, something horrendous. Entire Jewish communities all over America are being attacked for the simple reason that they are Jews. It is horrific what's going on. And one of the cases that, you know, that I brought to the public's attention were two young people walking on the Sabbath back home, 17 and 18 years old. They are attacked by a mob of eight people. The mob of Arab Muslims demand that they chant Free Palestine. These are two religious kids with their yarmulkes. They don't have a phone. It's the Sabbath. They beat them up. They punch them in the face. They use baseball bats to attack them. This is in the heart of the Jewish community in Brooklyn. So it is out of control. And by the way, Mike, we know the cases that have made it to the public arena. So many things are happening that are not being reported. You know, most cases never get reported. So things are really out of control. Unbelievable hate emanating from these young people, from the Arab Americans, the Muslim community, out of control hate. Very, very scary. And unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the leaders of the city, you know, they're condemning it now. But it took a while for them to say anything.
Better late than never, Doug.
Yeah, but you know, something is wrong.
No, you're
right. When it comes to other groups, it takes a moment. You don't have to think about it.
Split blink of an eye. Believe me, when I said better late than never, I was being sarcastic because
the
outrageous leadership, the way we see Democrat, almost always Democrat politicians, and you have to feel so betrayed by your party, your former Democrat party, because the leadership has been nil on defending the Jewish community.
Look, Mike, the Democratic Party, I'm sad to say this, and it's been quite a while, is an absolute disaster. And we are seeing it publicly. Look, we see the haters, the anti-Semites, the Talibs and the Omars, the role that Bernie Sanders and AOC, I mean, supporting the terrorists, Hamas, over Israel defending its citizens. I mean, what in God's name is going on in this world? It's like, yes is no, no is yes. Day is night, night is day. It's absolutely insane.
Well,
but let me tell you, the worst part is the so-called decent people in the Democratic Party, you know, not the radical left. They are intimidated by the left.
Coming up, abortion goes back before the Supreme Court.
Anything that upholds this Mississippi law means that Roe and Casey are no longer intact.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
In this week's edition of Meeting of Minds with Jerry Boyer, I talk with Christian philosopher Oz Guinness about what he saw when he came to America 50 years ago and what he's seen since.
I came here in 68. 100 American cities were ablaze. Martin Luther King, of course, assassinated in April, and then Bobby Kennedy in July. But the radicals realized, and here's the significance, that they wouldn't win in the streets. So they called for Herbert Marcuse and Rudy Deutschke and others for a long march through the institutions. In other words, win the high schools and the colleges and universities, win the press and the media, win Hollywood and entertainment, and then you've won the cultural gatekeepers and you can win the whole thing. And clearly, 50-odd years later, they've done it.
To listen to the whole thing, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. The Supreme Court has agreed to take up the case Dobbs v. Jackson, which examines the law passed in Mississippi that protects the life of the unborn from the point of 15 weeks gestation. It's the Supreme Court makeup we've been waiting for decades. It may well be the abortion case conservatives and originalists and pro-life people have been waiting for since 1973. The Alliance Defending Freedom has a long and impressive record in their work before the Supreme Court. Senior Counsel Denise Harley discussed the abortion case while on with me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Let's talk about Dobbs. I have a Washington Post column urging the Supreme Court to move expansively and expeditiously against these precedents. What is going on in Dobbs? Would you explain it for our audience?
You bet. So this is exciting. This is the biggest abortion case that's come before the court in quite some time. A little bit of background. Mississippi passed a law that protects unborn babies after 15 weeks, so essentially prohibits abortion after that point. Unfortunately, this conflicts with the very bad precedent that the Supreme Court has coming out of Roe and Casey, which says that, you know, women can do whatever they want. States can't really protect unborn life before the viability point, which is a bit later. But the Supreme Court has also said other things. The Supreme Court has said that states have an interest, a legitimate interest in unborn life from the beginning of pregnancy. They have a legitimate interest in maternal health and regulating the integrity of the medical profession. And so I think what's teed up is an opportunity for the court to correct some very, very fatal and wrong jurisprudence.
Now, to do so, they would have to overturn a 50-year-old precedent. And I quote in today's column, which is still in the edit process, John Roberts' concurrence in Citizens United, where he points out, if Plessy v. Ferguson had not been overruled in 1954, we would still have separate but equal. So bad precedents can go a long time before they're overturned. Will ADF be arguing in their papers, amicus or otherwise, before the court? I don't know if Dobbs is your case. Dobbs isn't your case, is it, Denise?
We so far don't have a lead role in that case. It's certainly the legislation is something that we completely support on principle, and we are standing by ready to assist Mississippi in whichever way they'd like us to assist.
And I'm sure you'll file an amicus because ADF knows the life issue. Like Matt Bowman is probably back on the team and writing about it. And that's why I want people to go to ADFlegal.org, ADFlegal.org/you. It's expensive to run this. Will you be arguing for a reversal of Roe and Casey? Roe is actually not even good law anymore. It's just a husk of itself into which Planned Parenthood v. Casey was implanted. But will you be arguing for repudiation of both precedents?
I think we'll probably ask for less than that because what we know is the Supreme Court can do whatever it wants. The Supreme Court has a wide range of outcomes right now. And so I think we'll probably be asking for something incremental that essentially guts the precedent of Roe and Casey as it stands. I mean, anything that upholds this Mississippi law means that Roe and Casey are no longer intact. And that is a fantastic thing because it means that states can now protect the sanctity of life, you know, for preventing late term abortions, allowing government by the people for the people. These are the kinds of laws the majority of Americans support.
Now, I am not, nor have I ever been a Supreme Court litigator, and you are, Denise, but I do believe it makes it easier for justices to grapple with an issue if it's fairly and carefully articulated in an amicus set of briefs as to why they ought to jettison something completely. Mississippi, I imagine, will simply be arguing to uphold its law. Is there not a rule here for amicus to point why those precedents ought to be totally gutted?
Absolutely, and that is what I expect you're going to see. One of the things that will be highlighted, but if not by us, then certainly by our friends, is things like Justice Ginsburg said that Roe was poorly decided. She called it a heavy-handed judicial intervention, and she says that it's caused problems ever since. You know, we and our friends are going to be highlighting the contradictions that happen when you say something like, well, abortion turns on viability. Well, what about science and medicine? What about we can see now that these babies in the womb can move their fingers and hiccup and they have heartbeats starting after just 3 weeks? We have ultrasound. We have a completely different situation medically where we are saving babies that are born very, very early. And so the idea that a constitutional right turns on, you know, the development of medicine was nonsense from the beginning. And that's one of the many things we're going to point out. Roe makes no sense, and it's not based on the Constitution.
And it also did not quiet the law. One of the key things that you look for when you're considering overruling an important precedent is, did that precedent have the effect of quieting the law? Just the opposite. It's created 50 years of controversy and division, and it should be overturned. Coming up, Dennis Prager exposes a school district near Portland.
The oppressor is whiteness? colorblindness, individualism, and meritocracy.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. School districts nationwide are debating critical race theory. Some entire states have outlawed the curriculum. Others have adopted it fully. In the area of Portland, Oregon, not surprisingly, they have taken it one step farther. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager reads from a piece out of the Cine Journal by Christopher Rufo.
He's talking about what's happening in the Portland area educational district. Educators at the Tigard Tualatin School District have gone all in on the social justice trinity of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Superintendent, last June, at the height of the nationwide unrest, Superintendent Sue Rika Smith and Board Chair Maureen Wolf signed a proclamation, quote, condemning racism and committing to being an anti-racist school district. The district announced the new Department of Equity and Inclusion and installed social justice activist Zinia Un as director. Un quickly created a blueprint for overhauling the pedagogy and curriculum at Tigard Tualatin schools. In her blueprint, Un describes the new oppressor as an amalgamation of whiteness, colorblindness, individualism, and meritocracy. These are the values of capitalist society, but for Un, they are the values of white society, the primary impediment to social justice. The oppressor is whiteness, colorblindness, individualism, and meritocracy. Color doesn't mean anything. The color of your skin is as important as the color of your shoes or the color of your hair or the color of your eyes, okay? These people are despicable fools to make color important. They are pure, undiluted racists. Every one of you liberals who votes Democrat is voting for a war against colorblindness. Individualism? The unique American belief that the individual is sacred. That, too, is a Judeo-Christian belief. Every human being is uniquely important. Not because of color, but because of who they are. And meritocracy. You reward merit. That's correct. That's why shortstops get a lot of money. They have a lot of merit. Shall we abolish meritocracy in sports? This part is about a father here. He says they believe their intention is to turn child against parent. After the anti-racism lessons, his child felt torn between school and family, sometimes crying in confusion. Quote, they're slowly going to get behind their defenses, get behind their parents' defenses, and create little social justice warriors, the father said. They're trying to hyper-empathize and hyper-emotionalize the children in order to get them to be more receptive to some sort of revolution. Your children are taught to have contempt for everything you value. According to drafts of the ethnic study standards, teachers will require kindergartners to learn, quote, the difference between private and public ownership of goods and capital, and develop understanding of identity formation related to self, family, community, gender, and disability. In first grade, they will learn how, quote, to define equity, equality, and systems of power, examine social construction as it relates to race, ethnicity, gender, disabilities, and sexual orientation. That's just what you want your first grader to learn, isn't it? In third, fourth, and fifth grade,
students must deconstruct the U.S. Constitution, uncover, quote, systems of power, including white supremacy, institutional racism, racial hierarchy, and oppression, and examine the consequences of power and privilege on issues associated with poverty, income, and the accumulation of wealth. Make their children into Marxists. If the elementary school curriculum sets the premise that the U.S. is the great oppressor, then the middle school and high school curricula deliver the conclusion. The learning standards read like an old left-wing pamphlet. Students must internalize the principles of race-based, quote, subversion, resistance, challenge, and perseverance. They must fight against the structural and systemic oppression of capitalism, authority, religion, and government, and they must commit to the pursuit of social justice. Then, describing a teacher, she and other teachers must submit to mandatory anti-racism training each week. Quote, from the beginning, we were told that we couldn't question the anti-racism program. I called human resources and asked them if I needed to profess that I believe in critical race theory and if I had to teach from this perspective. And I was told that I need to understand it. And I could probably lose my job if I didn't teach that way. If my principal is super into making sure the teachers are using this lens as they teach. At Forest Park, Whitman, and Marysville Elementary Schools, a teacher named Sarita Flores, who runs the information technology program, has transformed her role into that of a political inquisitor. Flores holds weekly anti-racism sessions in which white teachers are expected to remain silent, honor the feelings of BIPOC, black, indigenous, and people of color, and make space for and amplify BIPOC educators. In presentations resembling Soviet-era struggle sessions, Flores instructs teachers that they must, quote, deepen their political analysis of racism and oppression and start healing with public apologies about their racism and then go back and apologize through an audit through an anti-racist lens, unquote. During one of these sessions, Flores hosted an exercise resembling Orwell's 2-Minute Hate, in which minority teachers were allowed 90 seconds to berate their white colleagues. During the exercise, Flores denounced one of her white female colleagues by screaming, "You make me feel unsafe," repeatedly for 90 seconds. Afterward, Flores boasted on Facebook that she had publicly humiliated a racist, despite providing no evidence of racism or misconduct. It was a pure display of racial dominance.
For the rest of Dennis's comments, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
He may not have been telling the truth. The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, forces behind the U.S. pressure on Israel to cease operations.
We had more than 4,300 rockets fired at us in Israel in 11 days.
Supreme Court takes up an abortion case.
Right now you have a timid White House that is running scared of the left. Last week when Rashida Tlaib lectured the President of the United States, he immediately reverses his policy, tells Israel it must de-escalate and seek a ceasefire immediately.
And a court victory for churches in California.
This is permanent. It's statewide. It frees up all of the churches and places of worship in California.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The late Richard Nixon became synonymous with controversy in politics. But what we have been told about the events that led a president of the United States for the first time ever to resign from that office, not wholly true or complete. I had the honor of serving as president of the Nixon Foundation. I also had the honor of voicing a PragerU video on this important historical subject. Here is a portion. The most famous political scandal in American history is, of course, Watergate. Watergate was first and foremost a political war between the president, Richard Nixon, and the media, which in those pre-cable days meant ABC, CBS, NBC, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. The media's aim, in the words of British historian Paul Johnson, was to use publicity to reverse the electoral verdict of 1972. Why? What did the media have against Nixon? That's a complex question, but we can essentially boil it down to three things. One, he was despised by the East Coast liberal elite, of which the Washington Press Corps was a key component. Two, he was a staunch anti-communist. The media considered the communist threat to be overblown. Three, he refused to abandon South Vietnam. Nixon insisted on a peace with honor. The media was entirely anti-war. After serving as vice president under Dwight Eisenhower for 8 years, he ran against and nearly defeated John F. Kennedy. Then, 8 years later, and much to the media's dismay, Nixon mounted an improbable political comeback to win that year's presidential election. And then, as if rubbing the media's nose in it, he won again in a 49-state landslide in 1972. Something had to be done. Ironically, Nixon's own people provided the opportunity the media had been waiting for. On June 17, 1972, 5 men associated with the Nixon re-election campaign broke into the offices of the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate office building in Washington, D.C. Presumably, they intended to gather information about the Democrats' campaign strategy. Whatever their purpose, it was a painfully dumb plan that turned catastrophic when the burglars were caught in the act and arrested by D.C. police. Nixon found out about it, like everyone else, in the morning papers. Initially, he didn't think it was a big deal. "I had been in politics too long," he later wrote, "and had seen everything from dirty tricks to vote fraud. I could not muster much moral outrage over a political bugging." Today, most would conclude that if he had simply acknowledged his campaign's responsibility, owned it, as we say, fired those responsible and apologized, the whole sorry mess would have been rendered the minor incident it was. But as historian Evan Thomas noted, Nixon wasn't paying attention. And when he was confronted with the problems below deck, he didn't really engage. By the time he did, it was too late. So the scandal grew beyond his control. When it emerged that many of Nixon's private conversations were recorded, his fate was sealed. He resigned from office on August 9th, the first and only president to do so. The media had its victory and a newfound sense of power. The country has not been the same since.
You can find the entire PragerU video on Richard Nixon and Watergate at townhallreview.com. Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producers Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Harley Eide, Ben Brigman, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.